So our next speaker, keeping up with the tradition, is Eileen Sullivan, who's a former trustee of Teamsters Local 295, and who completed his transition from mob control to court control to member control. She's also a member of she's been a member of trustee staff in local Teamster Local 295, and a former Teamster tractor trailer driver and vice president of TW Local 504. And last but not least, she's been the AUD Women's Director and a stalwart AUD supporter for a long time.
And another life. Thank you very much. There's just one correction on that schedule. That's okay. The first union that's listed should say Local 851. Yes, that went from mob control to court control to membership control. And yes, I was on staff at Local 295 in that trusteeship as well. It's interesting. My daughter asked me last night, how did I get to be involved in this kind of stuff? And, you know, it was time for me to really reflect and prepare a few notes for today. And it was really hard to understand the evolvement and to see, you know, what changes have actually happened, you know, over the years. But it was good for me to reflect because I've never had an opportunity to really speak about this before except in, you know, pockets of just people together. So, I want to thank AUD for asking me to come here today and share some of my experience. I appreciate that. I also want to thank AUD publicly for so many other things, and I just want to take 30 seconds, if I may. I started out rank and file in Teamsters Local 282 as a truck driver, and it took women's groups to help get that thing going on Long Island for women in construction on Long Island. So, you know, the women's groups were there to help. And then I changed, and after that, into the 80s, I decided to get a job at the airport, and I soon, in the Transport Workers Union, became a dissident and tried to make a lot of changes in TW Local 504. I went to AUD for support and strength and help. They were there for me, and they certainly assisted. In the late 80s, after a lot of struggle in-house, we finally did a clean sweep of the administration that was not corrupt in the sense that we're talking about today, but clearly corrupt in the sense that members did not have a voice, were not able to participate, and the likes. So we did do a clean sweep. That was the good news, and that was thanks to AUD. And I say that because I so hope that this organization continues with the work that it's done, and it's helped so many people, and I'm one of those stories. That's the good news. The bad news is the day before we were to take over the local, in the new administration, the Union Hall was burned to the ground. So that was very unfortunate, but one of those things that is actually a product of the small C of corruption and unions and problems in-house. I'm not going to describe Locals 295 and 851. I think Ed said it so well when he discussed, you know, 560. Basically, all you have to do is change the names to incriminate the guilty. That's really all you have to do. But I will tell you, the industry, Local 295 and 851, is the trucking industry. It had been for years and years. 295 were the truck drivers, and they had clerical workers in-house as well, who were basically the mob-controlled families, sisters, aunts, uncles, you know, relatives, wives, and what have you, of the truck drivers in Local 295, incorporated Local 851. The leadership sometime in the 80s decided to give his son, mob-connected leadership, the corrupt people, a birthday present or anniversary present or some kind of present, and he broke away Local 851 from Local 295, and that started a whole new union, Local 851, where now this son could go out and make nice and have fun with this 1,500 or so members of this new union that he was able to give him. And you know, it just shows, you know, the ability of the mob to do whatever they wanted to do at the time. So basically, I'm here to tell you a tale of two trusteeships and my involvement in them at the time. I was not involved in Local 295 for a very long time, just 3 years. I had been working at AUD, as you heard earlier, director of the Women's Project, and I was invited to come into Local 295 to establish a training and education program, along with being a business agent for a while and doing contract negotiations. For Local 295 and 851, there are about 36 contracts that had to be negotiated for the total of about 1,500 members, 4,500 members to 1,500 members. The trustee was Tom Puccio, who was a Park Avenue attorney. And then there were two deputy trustees who worked under Mr. Puccio. But unlike 560, there was no one really brought in to explain how the rank and file really needed to be addressed. What were the issues that the rank and file would look for from new leadership? So there was none of that. Basically, the business agents who continued were those that were that had been loyal to 295 and the old guard. And no one was there to really make a change now in Local 295. So what didn't work was there was no rank-and-file experience. There were no membership meetings where the members could come in and have a free voice. There were no newspapers written to encourage open communication to the members. But what did happen was a lot of ridicule and disgrace to the membership. It seemed important for the trustee and the deputy trustee who was working everything on a day-to-day basis to remind the membership how bad the mob was while some of the mob people were still in the local and still working in the industry. In addition to that, there were no systems put in place for the members to get involved and to take on any kind of leadership roles. As Susan told you earlier, that I would discuss the fact that there had never been, up until the time I left Local 851, and I'm talking about a period of time from 1993 to 2000, were any charges pressed against any of the union leaders in-house in Local 295. So basically, it was everybody just staying within the realms of the local, continuing to do what they did. Obviously, the members resented it very much. The loss of control and power in the union was stifling on the job. And I say that, and what I mean by that is there had been lead people like dispatchers and lead clerks, and they called them lead men, in positions. And when the trusteeship came in, those positions were eliminated. And it appeared in Local 295 that any position of power, no matter what it was a bad position to be in. And so members were really stripped of any kind of power that they had at the workplace at the time. The loss of money, it cost millions of dollars for this trusteeship to continue itself. And the credibility to the labor organization itself was stifling because we couldn't go out and organize people with the shadow of this trusteeship in place at the time. The members were stifled first by the mob and then to some extent stifled by the trusteeship that was in place at the time. Lawyers were used for everything, and the bills just kept increasing and increasing, and there was still a lot of resentment. So that's some of the stuff that did not work in Local 295. What did work is that we did begin to develop a grievance system. There was no grievance system at the time. Nobody filed a grievance. If you ever had a problem, you spoke to, you know, one of the goons, and they would take care of it if you kissed the ring. If you didn't kiss the ring, it wouldn't be taken care of, and you were told, basically, you're lucky you have a job. So we set about discussing and educating members about their rights and how self-help didn't work, that you had to go through the grievance process. And we were also able to identify some alter egos within the industry. And when I say by alter egos, we talked about pensions being stripped of people and the likes. In the case with Local 295 and 851, if the boss didn't want to put you in the pension plan, he just didn't put you in it. And again, if you didn't kiss the ring, it didn't matter to the administration. You just weren't in the pension plan. So we were able to identify some of those shops that had these alter egos and get people put back or put into the pension plans for the first time. I left Local 295 in 1996 and then shortly after went into Local 851, which was a different type of trusteeship. In 295, there was a court-appointed trustee, and now in 851, Ron Carey asked me to be the international trustee with a court monitor. So now I felt I had an opportunity to do things a little differently. Significantly, the cost for the trusteeship had gone down. Not only that, employers were charged in criminal suits, lawsuits, and the local recouped millions of dollars for the membership. So there was an offset, you know, of the amount of money that was being spent on the trusteeship and what money was actually coming in. Basically, the court-appointed trusteeship and, I mean, the monitor and the investigator did their job and I did my job. They went about a very rigorous program of having all members fill out questionnaires. And those questionnaires were like 40 pages long, and it had everything in it that you could possibly imagine to address and perhaps weed out the fact that there was some connection and some corruption. If you did not fill out those questionnaires, you were automatically not you were enjoined from having any involvement within the union or running for any office. And dozens and dozens of old guard type representatives from the past were also enjoined and had no further involvement in the unions because of some of the questions and some of the answers that they put on the questions anyway. So there was a lot of that. Fines were imposed. And again, we recouped millions of dollars from employers who had violated the law as well. And there was a Teamster severance and pension package that was established in Local 851 as like a golden parachute for some of the outgoing labor leaders at the time, and we abolished that as well. So we went about a very rigorous campaign in Local 851, and we developed an infrastructure. And everybody has talked about that, you know, about how important it is to get the membership to be involved and to do what they want to do and be there for them. And so we set up an advisory board. We had standing committees that were working. And we did much internal organizing and tried to do some external organizing, but it was a little difficult when a local is in trusteeship, you know, carries that, you know, that brand, so to speak. The good news is that there was we had an advisory board that adopted new bylaws eventually. And this trusteeship had started in 1992, and Ron Carey had appointed a man named Kurt Ostrander to begin the trusteeship. And in 94, he came in, and I came in 1996. So he had already started some of the process of what I was able to then complete and do. But there was still resentment on the part of the members, even the good members, those individuals who you did identify that could help this local, you know, go into a brighter day and a new day for the administration. There was still a lot of resentment because the government was still, you know, had its hand in Local 851. They also perceived themselves as weak because of a lot of the structural positions of power in some of the union contracts had been eliminated, such as the lead men, as I said before. Another problem, I can't believe it's 2 minutes. Another problem is the influence now of Local 295 on the things that Local 851 needed to do. Because we were considered brother-sister locals, we held positions together at the Pension and Welfare Fund, and we negotiated the same contracts, only at different times. So there were times that Local 295's involvement and lack of their membership involvement in doing the right thing and getting everything going the way it should have gone negatively impact Local 851. But however, the good news is that there was an election in November of 2000. It resulted in the rank and file taking control of the union. Again, good rank and file people. People asked, did I run? I didn't want to run, and I'll tell you the reason I didn't want to run. I didn't want to mainly because I didn't come from that particular local, either 295 or 851, and I honestly felt my job was to train and educate them and let them control, you know, get back into controlling their own local. I didn't feel as though it was a place that I really should continue. I had some of my advisory board that disagreed with me, and we did put together a slate. We did not win, and I think a lot of that had to do with the fact that I was branded as the government person coming in and viewed as an outsider. So I felt badly for the board that, you know, helped me get a lot of this work done. So basically, the question that I was asked to answer or asked to address today was, can government and rank and file work together? I don't think it worked in Local 295, at least up to the point in 2000 when I was there. I didn't see any, or when I was connected to Local 295, I didn't see a good change at all. I didn't see an infrastructure that was developed for the membership. I didn't see any of that. I understand since then there was an election with the trustee taking a lesser role now, but I do know the person that's in charge now of Local 295, and that person had been one that would have been considered more of an intimidator, a person that wouldn't let you file grievances and would tell you you're lucky to have a job. So that concerns me. I think it worked better in Local 851. I think the saddest part about all of this within the last 12 years, as Ed says, that he was doing it, is that none of us ever really got together to share our stories and develop relationships and teach each other or try to help each other struggle through this stuff. I mean, I came in not knowing what to do or how to do it, but I knew as a rank-and-file member from the 1970s all the while what I wanted my union to be like. So that's what I really tried to do. In Local 851, as I said, there was an election. It resulted in the rank-and-file taking over and taking control of the union. There's been a subsequent election, but I leave you with this one point that concerns me. I told you that Local 295 and 851 were one union at one time. Then they split. Well, now it looks as though they may get housed. They are housed together again in the same office in Valley Stream, right out of JFK, Long Island. And that concerns me. I think it does not do us a service for those of us who are in the trenches and doing this kind of thing. And as Mike reminded me, risking our livelihood, to then just walk away from these trusteeships and not have an opportunity to continue to have some kind of involvement since we were there through the struggle. Thank you.
Okay, thanks for bearing with us. Our last speaker, not to be denied, is Ed Sedlowski, who's one of Chicago's best-known labor figures, labor leader, former district director of the largest district.
Actually, through a decree, and that the union had entered into that spring. The council's made up of 20 local unions, and has about 21,000 members in it. And we walked in there, took the whole thing over, and it was a mess. The council leadership was controlled by the Chicago mob and had been in there for generation after generation after generation. The Chicago mob had started the labor's union in Chicago back in 1910, Big Jim Colosimo and the street sweepers had started what then ultimately became Local 1001, which was then controlled when we went in there by Bruno Caruso and the Chinatown crew. These were guys that were the most jovial guys in the world, pat you on the back, laugh at your jokes and that, and also were capable of cutting your throat, and which they had done on occasion, not to us, but to other people. Prior to the takeover of the district council, there had been internal hearings to justify the takeover, and it constituted about 4,000 pages of testimony. The FBI had been following guys around and snooping on them and getting firsthand conversation, had sat in the booths in different restaurants that these guys frequented and what have you. And so wound up with 4,000 pages of testimony talking about anything and everything from assassination, who killed who, the skids man, how you shot him in the head, using the union car as actually a getaway car, a Chevrolet. And so it was pretty bad. They had the goods on most of them in that. And then along come COYA and the government, actually, of making an agreement rather than having the Department of Justice go in there. COYA said that, it'll be okay if we do this internally. And he put a guy by the name of Luskin in charge of this thing. Luskin was the in-house counsel of the laborers' union under Coya for about 8 or 10 years. And it was like putting the, you know, fox in the chicken coop. Well, I was pretty naive in that sense. I thought we were going to go in there and really clean house and that. And as it turned out, to make a long story short, every time you ran into something and you wanted to do what was right, you busted into a brick wall that turned around and another brick wall on the other side. And we had Local 5, your own home local. That Local 5 had been mobbed up, since the Capone days. It's in the Chicago Heights area. That whole area was nothing but mob and that. And I went in there and found that the business manager had walked away with about $250,000 over a period of years and that. He had a gambling problem. The mob was after him as well. I mean, the government, you know. But we didn't spend the time that I've heard people say 12 years or 8 years, and these were bad people. I mean, really bad people. We tried to set timetables that would do everything as expeditiously as possible, knowing that people resented us being in there. Even good guys resented us being in there. It was their local. And you talk to guys and they'd say, well, you know, I hope you clean it up and get it over with, and or, you know, that's the way business is done, or it's always been that way, and, you know, attitudes like that. And I was going in there with a whole concept of democratizing the labor force, and when we did that, they'd charge the gates with the pitchforks or so, and it changed all things around. Well, life is not really that way. It's, but we did put a time schedule on there among ourselves, and Joe Romano and myself primarily. We had both come out of the Steelworkers Union and had been through rough and tumble fights, not from a sense, and I want to make this very clear, not from a sense of gangsterism or a sense of mob control or rule, but just fighting for political offices within that union. That was a pretty tough task as well. But when we attempted to do in the labor's union what we had tried to do in the steelworkers' union and had been successful to some degree of democratizing, we met with stiff opposition as well. What we did is we went back to the membership night and day, night and day, night and day. Pool rooms, beer halls, bowling alleys, meeting in dry cleaners in the back room there where they used to meet at every day, getting to know guys by first name basis, going out on the jobs and first name basis. They got to know me, I got to know them. And we developed a mutual trust. In doing that, and there's nothing that equals that. The worker, you don't have to bullshit the worker or stuff like that. The worker knows when you're leveling with them and when you're doing the things that he wants you to do. And we spent about 3.5-4 months doing that. We had a big picnic that summer. I mean, the local threw a big picnic. Everybody invited, the family come, everything. And got to know everybody and then set up a training program for stewards and put stewards on the job. In every job we had stewards. It had never happened before. Stewards that were reporting, taking care of the guy's problems, ran training classes on how to be a steward, how to be a good steward. Don't let the boss talk you down. All of that, and all that's being comes into play. We're doing it time, day in, day out, day in, day out, day in. And before you know it, guys started calling me at home, Ed, I got something. Ed, you know, I want to talk to you about something. Ed, this and that. And you developed a trust with them. And that's a very good feeling when a guy trusts you, you know, and now you can't let him down. Then we held elections in that particular local union. I got 38 people to run for 10 offices. That had been the first time that ever happened in the history of that local, 100-year history. That had never happened in that local union. I came back to the district council that night, and my chest was sticking out, and I thought I had really accomplished something, and I made a report to the district council. 38 guys are now running for office in Local 5 for the election a month from now. Ooh, the fuck you trying to do? And it was just, you know, it was terrible. You know, I mean, you know, you were breaking down the whole structure here, you know. This is going to spill over to the, one of the other 20 locals in that council. Oh, you know, my God, it's thought I raped somebody's mother. You know, and it was terrible. And that, anyways, we had the election. There were 800 and some guys in that local union that was kind of on the downside. Usually that local runs about 1,100-1,200 guys. It was about 800 that were carrying a card. And we had 600 people vote in that election, 70-some percent. Bill came out there and hustled around in the saloons doing a story and that, and they wound up doing a story on him, actually. But so, I mean, it was great. We got that off the ground. Now, a couple of the guys that were elected didn't turn out to be worth the fiddler's darn in that, not because they didn't know the ropes or didn't know the score, but they were just horses' asses. They weren't about to, you know, service the membership as they should be serviced. So we still were overviewing that thing, and I would give them a tongue lashing or what have you, and try to perfect it where the worker would get the benefit of every shake, which had never happened in that local before. As I said before, that local had been mobbed up for 70 years or so. We moved over to Local 2 in the sewer and tunnel workers, the sand hogs. There was a local of about maybe 1,300-1,400 people. They were building the Chicago Sanitary Tunnel adjacent to the Chicago River and the Calumet River, 37 miles of tunnel work that would take in the storm and overflow questions. Largest municipal project in the history of the country at that time. And we did the same thing there. And it was a little harder. They were spread out more. They were all over Chicago and in the south suburbs. And it was hard to get them together, but we'd call meetings. It's five guys that show up on the north side, and then we'd call a meeting on the south side, and 20 guys would show and what have you. And we did that continuously and used the same pattern of being among the workers, being part of the workers, having the workers realize that you're one of us, you know, and you're trying to do good by us and that. Did that. Insisted that guys in that profession would be included in the master agreement that paid but like $2 more. And got that, just by virtue of insisting on it. Got it that it was almost that easy. And they had been deprived of that for so many years. Did all of those things, brought all of those things together, had another election, had an election in 260-69, which was on the south side. It was the old steel mill construction gang. And I can walk out. I'll tell you what I'm most proud of. I walk in any place to this day, and some guy will put his arm around me. And, hey, Ed, you know, that's a good feeling. I mean, that's worth all the damn 4 o'clock in the morning get-ups in the world. Believe me when I tell you that. But it's not easy. You got to put your mind to it. You've got to put your nose to the grindstone. You've got to do the things that a good organizer does. And it's not easy. It's not always that easy. But it works. The worker, look, collectively, the worker is the smartest force I've ever ran into in my life. There's nothing that equals that. Anybody tells you otherwise, bullshit. They know what's best for them. And I'd rather take their collective wisdom than the individual wisdom of any of us in the room. And it's just that way. So I enjoyed doing that after a while. I got a lot of self-satisfaction out of it. I did it in a couple of other local unions. And we got to become so good. I'm not shitting you when I say this now. They fired us. That's the truth. That's the truth. They fired Joe and myself both. And they fired us under the same way that they got rid of a lot of bums. They with the severance, they gave Joe 2 months' pay. They gave me zero. So they must have thought a lot more about Joe than they did of me. But all the bums, the sons of the real mafia guys, I mean, and there were cousins, brother-in-laws, it was unbelievable. When they severed any of them, they gave them a big, you know, pay. And then they gave them some attachments as far as their pensions were concerned, just so they wouldn't make no trouble in that. It could have been a lot better. It could have probably been a lot worse, but it could have been an awful lot better in that, you know. The consul has had two elections since then. Those guys aren't in the consul. I'm not crazy about who is, but they're not mob guys. And they've taken over the consul. None of the leg breakers are around anymore. And hopefully they'll never be back. So it can be done. It does work, and it's not simple. One observation, if I may, before I sit down. I got a minute, 2 minutes. I believe strongly in my heart, in my head, in my belly, that the labor movement is the only thing you've got going for yourself. It's the best institution that man's ever created. And all of it is not bad. We cannot paint with a broad brush, you know. The labor movement has gave all of us more than we would ever have dreamed for if it wasn't for the labor movement. Now, we got some bums around, and we should identify those bums, and we should rid ourselves of those bums. But I can't go around being silent and saying, listening to some guys think that, that's not true. That's not true. More often than not, I've met honest, hardworking, decent, dedicated people in the labor movement and that, in leadership roles. And I just had to get that off my chest. That was out of my craw. So thanks very much. And I ran over 30 seconds.
Well, it's been a pleasure being the moderator here in this Donnybrook. And we have a short break, I guess. Judy, we should...
About 10 minutes.
10-minute break, and then we'll come back for open discussion. I think Mike is going to be the moderator for the open discussion. Thank you very much.
I'm Michael Goldberg. I'm a law professor down at Wyden Law School in Delaware. I'm a member of the AUD's Board of Directors. And it's been a terrific and very productive day. And I know we've lost some people along the way, but we're very pleased by the turnout and pleased by the quality of the discussion on the part of all our panelists. I think some of the panelists had to leave, but all the ones that were remaining, we've asked to come up here, and so we can sort of get a general open discussion started, first by maybe asking the panelists to respond to each other, to each other's comments briefly. A minute or two, if each panelist wants to comment on anything said by one of the other panelists or pose a question for the group, and then we'll open up the floor for anyone you know who'd like to speak or comment or you know and so forth. But before I do that, I would be violating my fiduciary duties as a board member of the AUD without making a final pitch. I have, as a member of the board, I see the financial reports. Believe me, it is a shoestring operation with a very frayed shoestring. So anybody here who's not a member, we'd urge you to join. Anyone who is a member, we'd appreciate any additional contributions you might make. And whether you're a member or not a member, talk up the AUD among your colleagues and coworkers and let them know about it and encourage them to join. So with that, I guess we can start here with one of the academics on the panel, with Jim Jacobs. And any reactions or comments?
I think I'll just wait and hear what people have to say.
Herman,
I tell you, I there was a lot to be learned at this conference, and I'll tell you what I learned. And it occurred to me, I think, after I was listening to Jim Jacobs. Now, look at it this way. We're now talking about at least 20 years of government operations in this field, right? And millions and millions of dollars has been spent on this, remember. You heard about it. You know, millions and millions of dollars has been spent by the mighty U.S. government on this great project and all the human effort that's been put in. In addition to that, we have 40 years of rank-and-file efforts throughout the labor movement. Well, I can't say it's millions and millions of dollars, I regret to say, but it's been an overwhelming human effort. Is that correct or is that not correct? It is correct. And where is there an assessment of this huge effort by the government and by thousands of people in this little, what he calls a shoestring operation? It's almost unbelievable that this is the only place, not just the first time, but the only place where there's been any effort to assess this operation. And I found that, when I began to think of it, incredible. So let me take this opportunity to add one other thing to this. We've been saying how tiny AUD is, and this tiny organization did this. But we have one thing in common, I should add, with some of the mighty corporations in the United States. I would refer, for example, to General Motors and Ford. There is one thing we have in common, and that is, from a long-range view, we face bankruptcy. I mean, look at a long-range point of view. General Motors and Ford, with their billions of dollars, every year they have a slight deficit of $5 billion in this quarter, $3 billion in that quarter. Well, jotting it down, every quarter we have about, $2,000 deficit. There's a slight difference there, but in principle it's the same thing. In principle, it's the same thing. We have a long range, from a long range view, if this continues, we're faced with bankruptcy, and we have to rely upon you to help us. That's what it is. We don't have a hell of a lot of foundation support, very tiny. We've got to rely upon this small band of people, plus a few, maybe 500 or 600 outside of New York, out of town, so to speak, to keep this thing going, and I want to ask you to support us. That's it. Okay.
When you say assessment, the whole situation, it'd be a lot easier if the things that happened within the Teamsters Union after that election, and we could run around with a flag and wave a flag and what have you. It's hard to brag about getting a shoe up your butt.
On that encouraging note, Carl?
Yeah, I actually want to. Issue bomb. I want to follow up on the question of assessment, too, because assessment of, and what's the assessment here? Because I think the assessment today was generally positive. I think it was said that, maybe with the exception of the roofers, none of the unions are worse off for these, and many of them are better off. Yet, I want to sort of direct this to Jim Jacobs. I've heard, I forget exactly from whom, that among the sort of law enforcement community, they're not nearly as optimistic, and they're more hesitant to seek these remedies in the unions where there remains corruption. And I can't help but thinking of 1181 and why there is no RICO suit against that local. Jim, maybe you could cast some light on that.
Yeah, what I hear, is that the big change in the FBI after 9/11, fewer resources in general devoted to organized crime. The FBI is completely out of drugs. We've got a changing world. It's really, to my eye, remarkable that the attack on organized crime remained as high a priority as it's been for over 20 years, and they just took, wave after wave of prosecutions of organized crime figures. Of course, there's still cases, as we know from the John Gotti Jr. Episodes here, so it's still going on. But it wouldn't surprise me if there was a diminution of effort after a time. It can't continue forever. The window is only open, for so long for this generation. Then the window will close, and it'll be another generation or two before this problem commands the kind of attention that it has commanded. So I don't find that surprising. What I find more surprising is that these suits continue. That after a long period of time, the Longshoreman's case was filed and on the international, and it looks like there'll be activity there, and that there's still interest.
Could I say something on 1181? I don't think the issue is far from dead. Of the original 20 people that were indicted in 05, of which 17 were mafia outside of the union, and 3 were probably mafia inside of the union. And of that, 10 already have pled guilty and will be sentenced no later than December. In addition, the president of the union goes on trial October 23rd, and we have appealed, and this will be our final internal appeal on the robbed election to the International Executive Board. That took place. You weren't able to hear it all, but Simon, the second speaker, attended that and spoke before that board. That board will probably make a decision within the next week or two. And they have tremendous problems in continuing to cover up. And they're having tremendous problems with the 93 politicians that signed against them. And they're having tremendous other problems. I don't want to say we're going to win or lose. I think we'll win. And it is progressing with some good publicity. We hope we get more. And we will probably, we always could go to the DOL. The thing is to blow it up and get them, the international, on a cover-up. And that's a possibility. Or they break and they make certain concessions. And it's a 50-50 chance. We don't have a decision. We were just there this past week. And we will see. So it is not dead, far from it. And there is a rank-and-file movement. Without the rah-rah, we are succeeding. Still a tremendous amount of problems. But I want you to know that of the 20 indicted, 10 are going to jail, and 10 more just have a moment of possible peace before they go to jail. You should know that one of the crooks that is a capo of the Genovese crime family is fighting in court now not to allow a telephone conversation about a murder of X person. It just gives you a good flavor of this these pieces of shit.
Thanks. Thanks, Eddie. Bob?
Yeah, I have a brief general comment and a question I'd like to ask Eddie Sedlowski.
Bob, I can't, if you just speak in the microphone.
I'm sorry. Is that better? Okay. The general observation I'd like to make is the significance of union democracy for democracy and the idea that it goes way beyond people in this local or that local. And to emphasize that, I would just like to recall that during the 1950s, liberals and social democrats all agreed that American democracy wouldn't work unless unions exercised countervailing power over the corporations and the rich. And I think that a huge amount of American history and the whole tendency that we're seeing of the way the country is pulling to the right is a function of the lack of union democracy in its fullest sense. The question I have for Ed is based on an interview that I had with Robert Luskin. And I asked him, how come the charges against Bruno Caruso and all these bad guys all took the form of bad things that they did outside the union, and there were no charges such as the ones that you saw in the 212-page complaint about internal labor racketeering, taking bribes for letting non-union workers take union guys' jobs, et cetera, and so forth. And his response to me was, they didn't do that. He said, Bruno was a real gentleman. Is that the way you found it?
I found Bruno a gentleman?
Yeah, that they wouldn't stoop to that.
Bruno would snap your head off.
But he would say, may I first?
Not gently.
There was no labor racketeering going on in Chicago?
Oh, sure. I don't have my head in the sand, but it's not the way you paint it. I mean, Christ's sake, the way you paint it, you know that every guy and their brother that carries a union card is a bum. You know, and it's a thief, and I've read your book. I scratched my head in wonderment, and I said, you know, what you did was you jumped from pillar to post and cited little things on top of things. That's not what my labor movement's about.
Yeah. I'm sorry you feel that way, Eddie, but I wish you'd be specific. Who did I charge that you think I shouldn't have charged?
Oh, we'd have to go back in the...
Yeah, we'll wait.
No, don't walk away. I'm not walking away.
I'm not either.
I won't walk away.
But when you make a charge, you should be able to back it up.
I do. Your book backs them up.
All right. Barbara?
I was going to propose that we open the floor to questions.
Atta girl. Atta girl.
All right. So we do that? Yes. Can I just maybe set some ground rules? If we can keep the, because our time is short, and we got a later start on this session. So if we can keep the questions short and general. In other words, I don't think this can be a forum for going into detail about anybody's individual situation.
I want to thank Barbara for opening up a discussion by asking
you
a question. Your story about the consent decree, with all the excitement and emotion you had, I really shared in a way, because you proposed it as an alternative stemming from rank and file activity, an alternative to monitorship, to trusteeship, and so on, and maybe this is the way to go, and it should be a model. When you call it the quiet revolution, it brought to my mind
peaceful.
The Velvet Revolution, the Czechoslovakia, the Orange Revolution, somewhere in the Balkans.
Just interrupt for a second. Can you go to a mic, so that, because this is all being recorded.
Sorry?
If you're at a microphone, we'll be able to record all the comments.
I'm not loud enough?
Apparently not.
Hey, Sammy.
Sorry.
I'm not loud enough?
What did you say?
Anyway, those. How about this? Okay.
Yeah, go ahead, speak.
What? I mean, you can hear me.
Yes.
Anyway, those revolutions are still hanging in, in one way or another. But that revolution did not hang in. There was the counter revolution, if you like, to keep up the metaphor. And then you say it should be a model for other unions. It would be a great model for other unions. Now, the question is, could this consent decree have actually ever happened but for the existence of the CBU? The answer is no. Is there any other union in the country that has anything comparable to the CBU? The answer is no. I mean, the situation there was so exceptional and extraordinary that it made possible an extraordinary event that, in fact, turns out to be transient, something that's not easily repeated anywhere for any reason. And then, when you conclude that after all we've got to go back to the rank and file to get things done, when we just experienced the fact that the great rank and file movement in this country was not able to get things done, aren't we sort of repeating a mantra and having some sort of utopian idea about a rank and file that by itself can possibly achieve this? Now, the dictatorship in the TDU by Hoffman is so immense that it's hard for me to imagine any other activity that some sort of government activity could do something about that. And probably through the courts, trusteeships, locals here and there, whatever, initiated by lawyers. Or, and this is something I really don't want to happen, if in a fit of madness, Hoffman should absolutely murder somebody, and he has no reason to murder anybody. Maybe it would ignite the Justice Department and it's minded that on top of his murder. But all in all, I don't see in your very speech this reconciliation between some non-existent rank and file with a great consciousness. When all day we've been hearing about rank and file, it's hard to educate, it's difficult to educate, and when they do get educated, they turn around and don't know quite what you want to be, and so on. So I just make this contribution to the discussion today.
May I comment on it? Well, I suppose, first of all, as an optimist, to do my work, I have to be an optimist, and I am an optimist. And I think the reason I retain and hang on to my optimism is because of my work with rank-and-file Teamsters. And what I have seen is this, you know, my interaction with rank-and-filers is what continues to give me the strength to go on, because they are an inspiration in the Teamsters. And the rank-and-file movement, it's my impression, is actually, although you don't find something as organized, large, and comparable to TDU, still very much alive and well. If you go on to the AUD website, you'll see a list of rank-and-file organizations, and it'll be this for a Democratic Union and that for a Democratic Union and the other for a Democratic Union. TDU has served, continues to serve, as a model, as an inspiration, and as a motivating force for lots of rank-and-file movements that are now in existence and now organizing. Personally, I don't view Hoffa's victory and the current problems in the Teamsters as a counter-revolution. I view it as backsliding. And I think as part of a revolution, you have to assume that there will be much backsliding in the course of moving ahead. You move behind, you fall back, and you move ahead again. It's not a straight-up march to victory. Far from it. It's frustrating. It's difficult. The consent decree is far from perfect. It has inadequacies that are enormous that have to be worked on. But if we don't work on it, what is the alternative? It seems to me we must continue to do what we're doing because it is the way. And it also seems to me that we, as a group collectively, have an opportunity to make the biggest possible contribution to future generations by at least, I hope, sometime before we go, leaving a clear record of what we have done and what we have learned, and perhaps that will help the future.
But I'd like to do one last word.
And that is, I don't mean, I'm an enthusiast, as you may know. I've had something to do with AUD, and I'm still committed to all that. But I was more specific about a program and an attitude toward the government intervention. When you suggest the consent decree as a model of some sort, which I think is unique to that situation, and even there, it had the failure of the objective situation was overwhelming against them. I think it seems to me that the big story today in discussion is the crucial role of government intervention in one way or another, whether through the courts or whether trusteeships or whatever, which seems to me has to be a major concern. To the degree that the rank-and-file is involved, so much the better. And if not, well enough.
Just if I could briefly respond to that. I think that to the extent we rely on the government, we're going to lose, because the government has no comprehension of what our values are, what our fears are, what our anxieties are, what our problems are, and they will never succeed in solving our problems in any constructive way.
What I'd like to do,
Hoffa is a lawyer,
is ask anyone who'd like to speak to line up behind the two microphones. That way you can determine your own order of speaking, and we'll make sure you're at the microphone.
I would like to comment on that question also.
Go ahead.
I think, obviously, what happened with Kerry was a major, you know, significant, long-lasting setback to reform in the Teamsters Union. I mean, it had a devastating effect. And, you know, I just don't think there's any point in denying that. I mean, it was a horrible event that happened, especially after, you know, after Kerry was in power and did a great job while he was there. But still, the Teamsters has significantly changed as a result of everything that did happen. And I think that's the point that Barbara is making, and I think that is right. How things will change in the future, I don't know. I mean, it could in fact come from local union leaders of different Teamster locals who decide to band together and take on Hoffa, and it may not come through TDU. You know, I don't know exactly, you know, what's going to happen in the future, but there is a change in the atmosphere from what it was before. There now are people who are running as independent candidates, in this current international election that, you know, would never have happened before. And there's, although it's not what we would like it to be, but I think the situation there is better than it was before the consent decree, and I don't know anyone who would disagree with that. The other thing I do want to say is there is another union that has a group like TDU, and that is the Longshoremen. The Longshore Workers Coalition is a group, you know, throughout the longshore workers. They are organizing. They are meeting together. They have a network of people up and down the coast, and, you know, they are modeling themselves much after TDU, and they're taking a lot of lessons from that. They have a leadership based in the Charleston local, and I have great hopes for it. I mean, whether they can pull it off, you know, whether they win, I don't know. But I don't think the picture is as grim as you're painting it.
Can I make a very short? I don't want to go into the whole thing, but just one. I believe that whether you look at it from the point of view of a battle against the mob or whether you're talking about just simple maintaining union democracy as against the normal bureaucracy, that the rank and file, I don't know whether this is some kind of a heresy or not in this crowd, but I do not believe that the rank and file can do it by itself. I believe that in order to maintain democracy in the American labor movement, you must have the support of democratic government. The workers in their unions have to have the support of democracy on the outside in order to be able to maintain and foster democracy on the inside of the labor movement. That's the thing. That's my basic thought that probably governs my feeling about this whole conference.
I was just going to comment. I got here late, so I don't know what all has been said about Ron Carey, but I do know this, that I was very inspired by him and everything he did to raise the Teamsters Union and the strike, the UPS strike, and I was very unhappy when I heard the charges against him. So I went to every day of the trial. I was on sabbatical, and I went every freaking day. And the government had every chance to lay out every bit of evidence they had against him, and they did. And Chair Nash, the key prosecution witness, lied to the government. The government knew he was lying. He lied to get a lesser sentence because he was caught in criminal activity, but Carey was not involved. And I will never forgive TDU for letting Carey hang, because Carey was found not guilty by the jury, and that was very important. And when you don't defend your people against government attack, which is what Carey was subject to, then you're going to look fallible and you're going to look weak. And I think that was a big mistake on part of the TDU. I think it was opportunistic and it was fatal. And I don't think the fact that Carey was acquitted, I don't know what happened to the man, I don't know where he is or what he's doing now, but he was a victim of what the government will do when they come into the union. If you do a really good job, that's what they do to you. And I don't see how that could have been missed on anybody.
I worked in the airline industry.
But isn't anybody, wait, I want to hear a response from some of the people who think that was okay. I mean, surely you must, because you're not condemning it.
That's not entirely true. TDU did not let Carey hang. It had no choice about what happened to him and no control over it. But I agree. What I will say is I think Carey was punished far more severely than he should have been punished than anyone else who has committed anything comparable in the way of misconduct in the course of an election actually has been punished. He had the book thrown forcefully at him for something that he himself did not do. others were the actors. He, on the other hand, had a responsibility as the person in charge, a certain amount of responsibility. And to the extent that he failed to show the leadership that was required at the moment, he failed. He misstepped. TDU continues to this day to praise Kerry and his accomplishments. But it's not a one-dimensional matter.
I'll just say that what he did was not what the government said, and that's wrong. That position is politically horrible because you have to defend your people against government attacks. They may not be perfect, but you attack. When the government comes down on your leaders, if he was irresponsible, that's one thing. But kicking him out of the union, depriving him of his pension, and totally ruining what he had built and what you had built, and letting the government send somebody up like that is wrong.
I don't think anybody would disagree with you.
I could have stuck with him. I know you didn't do that because I was watching.
I don't think it was about Ron Kerry. You're making this, you know, that this was all about Ron Kerry. It wasn't. It was about the reform movement. And what happened was horrible things happened with union dues money under a reform leadership. Yeah. And that is what had a devastating impact. Whether Kerry went to jail or was thrown out of the union or not, I think it would have been really difficult for him to get elected even if he had been allowed to run. And I don't think the point was ever Ron Kerry is, you know, the saint or the devil. That's not the point. The point is the reform movement. And the reform movement stumbled very badly. And, you know, who's to blame for that doesn't even matter. Once the members saw, you know, the people we elected let this happen, whoever it was, you know, whichever people were responsible for it, under his guidance, this went on. That was devastating to the reform movement, whether he was guilty or not guilty.
All right.
It doesn't even matter.
Let's move on to another speaker and another topic.
I think I work in the airline industry. I'm a rank-and-file member. I've been a candidate for union office. I came here. I've been partially involved with AUG stuff. I've actually found a lot of the material very beneficial. So I came to see what would be. And I hear a little bit of sense that you're looking for an assessment, as Mr. Benson said, where you've been, and more importantly, where you want to go, what you want to do with this stuff. So I thought about some of the things. I don't work in a union that's, as far as I know anyway, overrun by mob bosses. I think that one of the things that might help those unions who are in that is for the rank and file members to be given some information about what are the signs that they should look for if they're in a union that has that type of thing. And once they see the signs, what should they do about it? Now, just a couple of really quick things. Look, if you've got a pension that's being run by your union, here are the kinds of questions that you can ask. Things like that that might start to tip them off and might start pressuring internally the union leadership. I think somebody spoke, and I don't remember who it was. It might have been Ed Steer, and he's not here, but he was talking about igniting the membership, the rank. That's absolutely important, but they're not going to spontaneously ignite. That will not happen. They do need leadership, and you've got to have leadership to collect. So I think that Ms. Janik's proposal to have AUD involving sponsoring workshops for union leadership, I think it's an excellent idea. It's a way to promote AUD and what you do on an institutional level, raise the visibility for the rank and file. And I will say, though, that the idea that Mr. Fitch advanced about democracy beyond the scope of your own union. I think somebody said early on that most rank and file members care about what is this union doing for me. And they really, the big tent union thing is really beyond it. If your own union can't get or won't even fight for what you want, I don't want them putting their arms around anybody else until they can demonstrate some competence in what they're supposed to be doing. And that, I think, is the problem, the fundamental problem with the Big Ten unionist theory, especially in the strange union that I'm in, which is predominantly a bunch of right-wing people that are uncomfortable to be in the union to begin with. So I think those are the struggles that I would advocate, finding some specific things you could do to increase the awareness of the rank and file of what they can do, and also the union leadership in programs.
I'd like to clarify the point I was trying to make, which is not that people are wrong to have the perspective that they do. It's entirely understandable to me that given the structure of unions in the airline industry, that the major battles going on are not between the unions and the airlines, but between the different unions that on a message that I got today consists of a debate over who sold out the strike. Was it the IAM? Was it AMFA? Who's the bigger scab? I think that the airline unions are an international example of union ineffectiveness and the futility of compartmentalizing the concerns of workers within these bounds. I'm sure that because of these union structures, a lot of workers hate the workers of the other unions. But what we want to try to do is create an institutional situation where they won't hate each other and scab on each other, but instead fight a common enemy. And it's our present union structure that prevents people from seeing their common enemy.
Well, in the case with AMFA, I think the real problem is that AMFA was an independent union that had it rated IAM or TWU, I can't remember which, to come in to represent the mechanics. And there was a lot of resentment on that property at Northwest. It was a bitter, bitter issue. And those folks up in Laconia, New Hampshire, are running a union in a box company. And I think they got basically what they bargained for.
Well, this is the kind of attitude that your industry has had since PATCO. You're still talking about PATCO, how they were interlopers.
AMFA is about themselves, not about anybody else. And they don't even care. So
yeah, but
they've got a dose to their own medicine, and that's what happens.
That's solidarity forever.